Author, folks. Next up on This Week in Law, we've got two great authors and thinkers about the web, Joseph Riegel and Cole Stryker. We're going to cover everything from online harassment and bullying of women and others to security fiefdoms, all the privacy and liability considerations in between. Don't miss it. These guys are smart. Next up on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 241, recorded January 10th, 2014, made of plastic and tears. Hi, folks. Happy 2014, and welcome to This Week in Law, our first episode of the year. Really excited because we've got a wonderful duo of guests joining us today, both authors and thinkers on issues right at the heart of technology and the law, and some of the most important issues, I think, as we begin the new year. First off, I'm going to introduce you to Joseph Riegel, who's an assistant professor of communication studies at Northeastern University. He's also a faculty associate at the Berkman Center at Harvard, an author, and working on a new book called Comment: Likers, Haters, and Manipulators in the Age of the Web, and has written in the past with Professor Lessig a book called Good Faith Collaboration, which is about Wikipedia culture. Hello, Joseph. So glad you could join us today.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Really wonderful to have you. Joseph also does research on geek culture and women, which is also quite topical at the moment. We're going to get to why that is in just a minute. But first, I want to also introduce Cole Stryker, another author. Cole has written about 4chan and also about privacy, identity, and anonymity on the web. His two books are called Epic Win for Anonymous and Hacking the Future. And Cole is working on a third book called The Deep Web. So really thrilled that you could join us today, Cole, as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. And also coming to us from a balmy 33 degrees in Chicago. So glad that it's not minus 7 there today, Evan. Evan Brown, lawyer at Info Law Group and our co-host here at This Week in Law. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy New Year. Really looking forward to getting this kicked off. Should be a wonderful conversation today. So great to see you.
I know. Great to see you, too. Missed you over the break. It's really great to be back and see you again.
Yes.
All right. So let's get into it. Our stories today kind of all concern the social web. So let's start there. There we go. All right. So let's start out with the issue of bullying and harassment, because over the break, while we were dark for the last couple of weeks, a story broke that is, you know, all too common, unfortunately, this time involving a woman named Amanda Hess, who writes about adult kinds of issues on the web. And she's not a stranger to having sort of, you know, sketchy people contact her or react to her writing on the web. But this time, you know, someone definitely crossed the line and threatened her and terrible ways told her that she was going to not be able to continue on because he was coming after her. So she went public with it. She reported this activity to the police. It's just unfortunately, the latest in a series of high profile stories about women being threatened on the web. Amanda says that it's not exceptional, and because, you know, obviously we've talked about this a lot on the show, we agree, but it's just the latest in demonstrating that it's different for women on the web. And this is something that Joseph has spent a good deal of time thinking about. So I'm wondering if you think anything, we can learn anything from Amanda's story or you know, what's the current state of this situation that led to her story, Joseph?
It's really terrible. I don't think there's anything immediately on the horizon that's going to solve it. I think women today online have to be very careful about the information that they put out there. There's just, you know, a huge list of history. The website Geek Feminism has this wonderful wiki that just has dozens and dozens of instances of abuse against women. And I just saw a website today that was talking about how the old notion of ignore the troll or don't feed the troll isn't sufficient. And I think that's quite true, because I think that idea of don't feed the troll comes back from a more innocent time of the 90s, when the troll typically was the odd, idiosyncratic, typically man. And nowadays, I refer to it as a trollplex. When you do face this sort of harassment, very often you're getting, you know, nasty emails, nasty phone calls. People might be sending things to your house, as in the case of Kathy Sierra. She had to move out of her house. Some people are seemingly legitimately criticizing you for something, and it just combines into this sort of overwhelming hate storm, and it can be just completely debilitating. So it seems to be that the current thing that one can do is simply to document it, and perhaps, and I hope this is a growing stage, that at some point, it'll reach people's consciousness and say, this is really awful. Shouldn't we do something more about it? And Danielle Citrin, who you might know of, she's written a book called Hate 3.0, and she makes a number of nice sort of observations and a history of what's going on, and she has some recommendations.
So, yes, I'm sure that Danielle's recommendations are good ones, and we, you know, should refer to those, and I hope that policymakers will refer to those as they ponder these issues. But that's an issue that we struggle with here on This Week in Law, is, you know, obviously there's an untenable situation, yet we are... we tend to be huge fans of people being able to maintain their anonymity on the web and their free speech on the web. And so those considerations collide in sort of a throw your hands up and what are we going to do about this way over this issue. And so we've
got... Have you heard that expression, freeze peach?
Freeze peach. No, what does that
freeze
mean?
Freeze peach. So often free speech is invoked in a lot of these harassment cases that I guess supposedly, perhaps on the feminist side, it's become a sort of sarcastic rejoinder of someone starts saying, I can be an asshole and I can harass people because that's my free speech. And it's sort of a parody. Free peaches or something like that. Right. Susan Heron did this wonderful work back in the 90s about email lists, actually, and things really haven't changed. In fact, they've gotten worse. And she actually says that much of the sort of online hacker ethos is very much rooted in this libertarian notion of independence. And she was trying to figure out why men and women flamed or didn't flame. And at first she thought it might be related to the fact that men and women have different standards of politeness. Again, I'm talking in the aggregate. There's lots of exceptions across both genders. And she actually said men and women in her study both felt that politeness was different, but that what made men a little bit different is that their notion of politeness differed, and they felt it was their sort of duty to enforce particular norms of what they considered to be logical and substantive discussion. And it was perfectly okay for them to sort of go after people, particularly women, if they seemed soft, right? Which is, I think, what prompted some of the attacks against Kathy Sierra, because she said things like, oh, you should program like a girl, you should program beautiful, elegant code. And that just ran, you know, put some people off and prompted a range of attacks, both from legitimate sort of seeming sources as well as from people who were simply trolling her.
Well, Cole is no stranger to a culture of trolling, I suppose, having spent a lot of time analog study on 4chan. So Cole, I'm curious what your response is to all of this, and whether you think that the web is just a wild and woolly place and there's no solution to it, and it should not be regulated so as to take out the current capability of people to be anonymous and vicious, or whether there's something that needs to be done here that is reasonable.
Well, it's certainly a very complex issue, and it's something that I, you know, I have to take a step back and recognize my privilege as a white male, even though I have received death threats and various trollish attacks against myself as well as my family and friends as a result of my writing about trolls. Nothing I've ever experienced can be compared to what is happening to Amanda Hess and others. You know, I've never felt like I was in real danger, or that I, needed to, you know, move or leave my house or find somewhere else to live. That being said, I think it's really, obviously it's a difficult issue. And, I think one of the values of anonymity, which is something that I champion in the last book, is that it can be quite empowering for people who find themselves victimized by these sorts of bullying behavior. I don't think it's necessarily a solution for Amanda Hess to go completely anonymous. I think her work is valuable, and I would like to live in a world where people like her feel free to operate online and speak out using their own names. But I also, I'm really happy that people like her can speak anonymously when they're being targeted, and that it can be a way for people to get their message out while being protected from these kinds of threats. I think the ultimate problem is that whether or not we want to live in a world where someone's behavior can be traced so that they can be punished when they're being abusive, whether or not we want that world, we simply don't live in it. And, you know, creating some sort of new kind of internet where there's a authentication wall in order that would enable people to be monitored 24/7 would have these vastly deleterious effects on free speech, among other things. So I just, you know, obviously different platforms have to deal with this issue in different ways. And I applaud major social networks for, you know, hiring child safety experts and things like that to make sure that their platforms are more conducive to productive, friendly speech. But as you know, not everybody can be Twitter, not everybody can be Facebook, and hire an army of lawyers and in order to combat stuff like this.
Well, Evan, I'd like to have you weigh in on this if we could, our third white male on the panel, and see if you have anything to add.
Well, I mean, from a legal standpoint, I'm not sure there's a whole lot we could do when it comes to the law or regulation, because we have a framework that's, by and large, pretty effective toward giving remedies for such bad situations like this. And here's what I mean in particular about that. We have the law of defamation. We have the laws, both civil and criminal, dealing with harassment. And we have a framework that is embodied in this evolving body of case law. And just, you know, this past week, there was a case involving Yelp that we were talking about before the show, and maybe we'll get to it here at some point, about the standards that courts should apply when determining whether to unmask an anonymous online speaker. And on top of that, at a larger, more general level, we have pretty well established constitutional law coming from the Supreme Court that there is no First Amendment right to, for example, engage in hate speech or engage in defamation or things like that. So there's no real semblance under the law under which this vicious type of language, these hurtful types of communications, are protected. We've got the First Amendment that protects expression that doesn't do all that. So it leads me to think that there's probably not a whole lot we should even meaningfully endeavor to do from a law and regulation standpoint. It really has to come from an approach that looks at norms and looks at the human heart. I haven't studied this, so I'm only going anecdotally by what I know as a member of society and as, you know, having known people and read about things and looked at history. But my sense is that misogyny is nothing new. I think it goes back quite a ways. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, if misogyny is a 21st century novelty. People can be
pretty... Well, it's only novel in that before it was just accepted as the norm.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So I think that plays into the idea that the difference that we have now in the 21st century is that we have these technologies which give the depraved individual, and I'll just go ahead and say that whomever that was communicating with Amanda Hess is depraved at a very fundamental, essential level. You know, that's a very flawed person. I'll go ahead and make that judgment. And if anybody wants to dispute it, we can do that. Anybody wants to debate that. So we have the technology gives us more opportunities to engage in these sorts of dialogue that are very harmful and they become very public when the target is someone like Amanda Hess. And I guess that she's by no means the exception when it comes to, you know, being a woman who receives these types of communication. So, you know, there's something that's just, it's just very, we're put in a situation now with the 21st century, with all of these abilities to communicate this way, in a situation where a very depraved individual, especially males who are motivated often by a certain distorted, misguided, searching for the right word here, an off sexual impulse. I mean, the Amanda Hess thing as an example. I mean, this is all a very sexually violent thing. And I don't know. I don't want to get all moral majority on this, but you know, we've talked about this, Denise, on the show before. The pervasiveness that technology affords, like no other time in history, of ways that mostly males, but I mean, you could talk about it at humans in general, but mostly males going after pornography, satisfying or seeking to satisfy sexual desires and impulses in ways that, you know, nature does not intend. And evolutionarily, we've never been presented with, the opportunities for pornography and sexual gratification. So there could be something very fundamental at the level of the human soul that's manifesting here, which the law and regulation is far too powerless to even begin to touch. So
is it a mistake to focus on the First Amendment? Because much of these communications are happening through proprietary networks which have terms of service, right? So there was a case recently where women who had been advocating for a woman other than the Queen to appear on a British banknote, they received tremendous amounts of abuse, and supposedly this inspired or prompted Twitter then to say that they're going to deploy abuse buttons. And I posted something in IRC. Someone tweeted this, Greg Callis, Guardian gets 600,000 comments a month and employs 12 full-time moderators, the Guardian newspaper. Twitter gets 400 million tweets per day, hence it would be impossible to do this technically. So I would say that it might not even be that much of a legal issue, since much of this behavior would violate terms of service of the proprietary networks. But even then, is it technically or organizationally possible? And I think that's an interesting question, too. Some sites obviously manage to do it better than others. And I think that also relates to scale. Twitter is just huge. And one of the ironies, much like Cole was saying with respect to anonymity is a double-edged sword, right? It can serve people who are trying to avoid stalkers as well as serve stalkers. And the abuse buttons, too, can be used by abusers to go after people. So, for example, when Anita Sarkeesian proposed that her project could be crowdfunded to look at tropes in video games, people used the abuse buttons on, I think it was Kickstart or one of the other services she was using, to say that her project was in violation and abusive. And so very often, again, one of the sadnesses is when you apply, when you deploy abuse features on these networks, very often they can then be bounced against other people as a form of harassment, which makes it just all the more sort of frustrating.
Right. You're abusing the abuse button. Which
exactly
is very hard to police when you're talking about volume on the scale of I'm sure, Kickstarter and certainly Twitter. Evan, getting back to your point about cultural norms and heart, I think there are at least a couple of things worth paying attention to that may impact where this goes and how lawmakers continue to think about and attempt to regulate the issue. I don't know how many folks have seen Jamie Kilstein's video on male privilege. And maybe we can show just a bit of that. There is some language in there that would prevent us from showing too much, but you can get the gist if we can roll just a bit.
Hello, Internet. White guy here, so I'm pretty sure that means you have to listen. I'm also straight. I'm cis. I'm not poor now, but I used to live in my car. Not just any car. I used to live in a Saturn, which I'm pretty sure is made of plastic and tears. But I'm doing okay right now, and that pretty much means that I'm as privileged as you can get, which guarantees that I will not be stop and frisked, and that I'm boring.
So yeah, Jamie uses some colorful language and makes some excellent points. I'll let you, we put everything we're discussing on the show in our delicious links for your perusal at your leisure later on. And this is at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/241. If I can just summarize where Jamie goes with his tirade on, it's not really a tirade, it's more social commentary on being a white guy, is that you just should not treat women like a jerk. Don't be a, and he uses a more colorful modifier than jerk. In less colorful language, the Washington Post actually has a very similar article on what we can do about online harassment of women. And it all comes down to, smart people, sensitive people with heart not being a jerk. So there seems to be a good deal of attention to the issue, a good deal of discussion and reaction by people who are outraged by this kind of behavior, pushing back on the fact that it's been commonplace and de rigueur, and that a lot of those people are in the white male camp. And then even more tilting the scales the other direction, again, I don't know if people have read the book or heard of the book, there is a book out there called Men on Strike. It's authored by PhD Helen Smith, who happens to be the spouse of Glenn Reynolds, known widely online as the Instapundit. So the kind of funny thing about this book, or ironic thing about this book, is she's writing about why men are boycotting marriage, fatherhood, and the American dream, and why it matters, and how there's... Again, I have not read the book, merely read reviews and heard about it. I definitely have it on my to-do list to read. But as I understand, the gist of it is that the societal pushback is starting to put white men in slightly less of a privileged position and starting to question the entitlements that they've had and leaving them in a situation where, it's not as great as it traditionally has been for you, and in fact, maybe tilting toward pretty dire things in store for white males growing up today. The ironic thing about it is that, she's written this great book about an important issue, and yet still is referred to often online as the Insta-wife, because she is the Instapundit's spouse. So proving that the original problem with women is still persistent, even at a high academic level, I would think. So guys, let's go around the horn one more time on this issue before we move on to other topics. And what I'm interested in with that background is whether you think that the cultural norms are shifting, and whether they're shifting too glacially for it to make too much of a difference to someone like Amanda Hess. Let's start with you, Joseph.
Okay, so I did want to say, in terms of norms, one place is where we are seeing some advance is associated with conferences. So the ADA initiative, which is dedicated to advancing and involving more women in technology and open culture, they put out a sort of a best practice. Here's some code of conduct in terms of what we consider to be harassment. And if you do this, you're going to be kicked out of the conference. And originally, they were somewhat controversial. They remain a little bit controversial among some people, though a lot of places are now accepting this and advancing codes of conduct at their conferences and otherwise in their communities. And I think that's a great thing, and I think we can see some progress with respect to that.
Okay, Evan?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time accepting the premise that there's really such a thing as white male privilege. And I'm looking at my own life, which is the only example I have to draw from. It's the only life that I've experienced. And then, you know, I can look at the life of my peers as well. Those who have enjoyed success have worked very hard for it. And sure, I had plenty of help, you know, from my parents, and, you know, I live a good life, but you know what, I've made a lot of sacrifices for it as well. And so, you know, maybe that just puts me on the wrong path to have any meaningful commentary, on this, as far as, you know, addressing a specific problem, you know, couched like that. The larger solution seems to be that a person needs to cultivate within himself. And I'll go ahead and use the gender specific pronoun there, because this is the issue that we're talking about, needs to cultivate within himself notions of reasonableness and fairness and patience and understanding and humility, all of those things that are characterized in spiritual terms as, you know, fruits of the spirit. And, you know, in that way, that's where real social change is going to happen in a meaningful way and in a positive way. I think that there's that the dialogue of accusing people of you know, coming to the situation from circumstances of privilege is only going to serve to alienate those people more. I haven't read Helen Smith's book, so I can't comment on that. I mean, I find that really, you know, if it's true that white guys are kind of opting out of normal traditional roles for themselves because they don't find the rewards, that seems to me to be kind of selfish. And again, I'm looking at myself. I mean, the reason that I have taken on the roles that I have taken having a wife who stays at home, having a job, providing for my family, doing those things which seem to be going out of vogue, at least, again, I haven't read the book, so I don't want to characterize it too much. I've done that for, you know, out of what I think of as selfless norms. I could very easily have just kind of gone on my own and not chosen to have a family and all that stuff. So I don't know where I'm going from all this. I guess I just think that we could probably have the conversation in a way that is perfectly non-alienating, and where white guys don't have to start all of their comments with apologizing for being white and straight and relatively affluent. You know, I'm not about to apologize for all the good things in my life. So take that for what it's worth. I have no idea what I said.
I liked Jamie's intro to his video because I didn't feel like he was apologizing. I felt like he was contextualizing and adding a bit of humor to some serious discussion. But Cole, one of the things we were just discussing is not just that white males are perhaps finding themselves in a different boat, but also that this voice of reason seems to be getting out there as far as harassment and bullying on the web, and a cultural norm seems to be shifting there, perhaps. Or, you know, as our 4chan expert on the show today, do you think that there's validity to that?
Well, I think, you know, there's a part of me that wants to think things are getting better all the time. And I think that the dialogue that we're seeing now between people who might self-define as men's rights activists and, you know, I'm a pretty active Tumblr user, and there's a community on Tumblr of people who are very passionate about social justice. And I occasionally tease them as being SJW, social justice warriors, who have become so militant in their passion about social justice issues that they actually come across as quite aggressive and violently so, calling calling for the heads of powerful men and things like that. I think both parties, men's rights activists and what I jokingly refer to as social justice warriors, have a tendency to be a little myopic. And but what I love is that there's this conversation happening now. I had never heard the word cisgendered 2 years ago, and now I feel like I see it every day. And some might say that that's just sort of a ridiculous, made up word. But I think it kind of all boils down to a sense of humility for me. Earlier when I mentioned I'm a white male and the harassment that I've received is nothing compared to what Amanda Hess is dealing with. I think part of that awareness of privilege is really just comes down to humility and recognizing that I do enjoy a lot of benefits from being born looking the way I look. I'm just as privileged for being white as I am for being born in one of the more prosperous countries in the world. And I think that like gratitude and humility, going back to the, fruits of the spirit that we referred to earlier, I think that you can take these kind of social movements and reduce them to a more of a holistic category, I guess, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, well, on that holistic front, my concern of, for instance, the book you mentioned, is people have been concerned about men who suffer in particular ways, be it through the legal system or going off to war since Warren Farrell's The Myth of Male Power in the early 1990s. So this isn't necessarily a new argument. My concern is when these two things, feminism versus some men, are sort of getting screwed, I'm not sure that those things are necessarily in relation with one another. Lots of people can suffer in different ways. And so right. I wonder if, to what extent this is really sort of a false equivalency. Are we capable of having a sophisticated enough discussion where we can say women are being harassed on the internet on one hand and men are getting screwed in divorce courts on the other hand? I'd like us to be able to do so, but it seems not likely.
Right, and certainly women don't have the market cornered on harassment and bullying on the internet. You don't have to be a woman to find yourself in that situation. And I guess with that in mind, it's worth exploring for the sites themselves that facilitate all of this communication, beneficial and otherwise, what their societal concerns should be and what their liability protections should be. We have a great write-up from Professor Eric Goldman, longtime friend of the show, frequent guest, talking about the Dirty case. Evan, I don't think this is the first time that we've discussed this entity on the show. Of course, Section 230, which is something that protects websites from the unlawful acts of their participants, the speakers that they have as users under certain circumstances. The Dirty case is just a recent development in Section 230 law and ongoing. Evan, have you been paying attention to this one, and how do you think it shades our discussion?
Well, it's a great focus or showcase for, this problem of the liability for the intermediary when the nature of the content is really offensive. And the fact that the content was so offensive seemed to really guide the district court judge's decision in all of this. And so this is the same problem that we have, the same legal problem that we have, the same policy problem that we encounter when we're talking about revenge porn. We enjoy the robustness of Section 230 immunity with no problems at all, enjoying it when it's couched in terms of like, well, but for Section 230 immunity, there would never be a Twitter, or there would never be a Google, the internet wouldn't exist in the form that it is today. We have no problem lauding Section 230 in those circumstances, but it's much more difficult when it gets to those circumstances where somebody's doing something really obnoxious, probably illegal, by facilitating and this is the second time I'm really struggling pretty hard to find the right word here, because this is where the jurisprudence comes in as to what it means to be the operator of a website versus simply allowing third-party content to be passed through that platform. You know, with situations dirty and situations like Is Anyone Up, you've got this little bit more, this little bit of commentary, this invitation, this inducement of this really highly offensive content. And that makes it much more difficult to laud Section 230 in those circumstances. Joseph?
Yeah, and I don't think it's so much about the offensiveness. That's the thing that's obviously catching our attention. And, Goldman is a lawyer, so I have to concede the ground to him in terms of what the law says. And I've disagreed with him in the past. For instance, he said Wikipedia could go kaput or blow up in by 2003 or something like that. It didn't happen. But with respect to, I think what the judge was saying, and this is something that's confounding me, is if a site were merely to say, yes, we are a common conduit and people post messages and we are not responsible for those messages, you deserve the immunity afforded to you by 230. But what courts have been deciding, and Goldman is right in terms of speaking of precedent, it's that even like eBay, when they have one of their own employees solicit someone to advertise on their site, that person refuses, and then that employee writes a bad review, which is then put at the top of that service's site on Yelp. That seems to go beyond simply saying we are a repository for user-generated content. And similarly with the dirty, they're actually soliciting some of this content. And some of these reputation services also hide behind Section 230, where they say, we have this horrible thing on our site that's been written about you, and if you pay us $1,000, we'll put a do not index tag on the webpage. And so, these are sites that are not simply providing a forum. They are exercising the editorial control. Granted, the editorial control is a little bit different in terms of how are you promoting the content or deprecating the content, or are you putting a no index tag on the page? But to me, that seems that you're exercising editorial intentions and authority, and that should remove the 230 immunity.
Right. Certainly, if you're trying to use it to hold the subject matter of the statement ransom, and that's the equivalent of some of this ransomware that shows up on people's computers, as far as I'm concerned, and I would hope a judge would be concerned, that yes, you've definitely waded into the editorial active role there and taking
But the courts have been surprisingly hesitant to make that sort of distinction, which has surprised me, but I'm not a lawyer.
Right. Let's see, Cole, any thoughts here on, we should mention what the dirty lawsuit is about. It's the plaintiff is a former teacher and NFL cheerleader, and there were allegations about her, defamatory allegations that she sued over and won a judgment that she was unable to collect against the site that that ran the comments, talking about her, promiscuity with a football team, and also alleged she had an STD. So this lawsuit is ongoing, and what Evan was alluding to is the fact that, the comments were, the situation that the plaintiff, Sarah Jones, was put in was so awful that it seems to have perhaps skewed the judge's analysis under Section 230, although, as Joseph's pointing out, sometimes that analysis gets pretty murky depending on the particular facts of the case and how involved the site was. So, Cole, do you have any thoughts about site liability in these kinds of situations?
I don't have a heck of a lot to add to what's been said. My background is not in law either, so I can tell you that 4chan, which is the subject of my first book, has a pretty no tolerance policy for anything that could get them in trouble legally. So any sort of threats or child pornography are pretty much the only two things that qualifies under that. It's just like an immediate ban, and then potentially your information is handed over to the appropriate authorities. A lot of people say that there should be more done on a lot of platforms, but you know, obviously these companies have limited resources and they're only going to protect themselves insofar as avoiding a lawsuit. So I'm not sure what the solution is here.
And Denise, you mentioned STDs, and there was a site called STD Carriers where people would, the whole site was dedicated to posting claims about other people having STDs, and they were actually the service that would place the no index tag on their pages so you wouldn't come up in Google anymore for an extortive fee, but they're now defunct, fortunately, for whatever reason.
Well, that's good to know. Let's move on. We're talking about when people should be unmasked or not when posting online. So we're getting into issues that involve both the social web and privacy and criminal prosecution. I think we'll go ahead and add our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these passphrases in the show. If you're a lawyer listening for continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction or another professional who can get credit in your field, we put these phrases in so that you can demonstrate to your regulatory body that you've actually listened to the show. Some oversight bodies like to have that kind of confirmation in there. So let's make our first one the dirty, just all one word, in honor of the discussion we're having here. So moving on to review sites and as opposed to things that are more on the fringe, such as the STD site you were mentioning, Joseph, review sites have to deal with this kind of issue every single day and face that control and volume and the abuse of the abuse button issue that we were touching on before. In the news just today is the fact that Yelp has been ordered to unmask the identities of seven anonymous reviewers who were accused of having concocted negative reviews about a carpet cleaning company. So that company has gone ahead and sued Yelp to turn over the identities of these people. Yelp initially refused. The case went to court, and now they've been ordered to reveal the identities so that this plot, this alleged plot to undermine the business, could be pursued on a legal basis. Evan, do you have any problem with the way this is unfolding?
Well, it looks like, that the court applied the law here. Whether they applied it correctly or not, that's kind of the perennial question when we're sitting around talking about cases, right? The issue is whether or not the plaintiff, this carpet cleaning company's right to seek redress for the allegedly defamatory content posted to Yelp, whether that outweighed the First Amendment interest of these folks to speak anonymously. And when we have talked about this in the past on the show and usually in everyday conversation about this issue, there's a hall of fame of cases that always come up when you're talking about this. From Connecticut, there was the Cahill case from 2005. There was a New Jersey case called Dendrite from earlier than the Cahill case. And then even earlier than that, there was a case called Seize Candy that articulate differing standards, but about what a court should do, differing standards that a court should apply when determining whether or not an anonymous defendant should be unmasked. And at a general level, the general principle is that the plaintiff needs to come to court with some facts to support the strength of the allegations that a tort has been committed, so that we can be assured that these anonymous parties won't be identified to the peril of their First Amendment interest, indeed their First Amendment rights in many situations to speak anonymously. In this case, the plaintiffs who were, you know, had very good, or, I'm sorry, the Yelp, who had sought to protect the identity of the anonymous parties, had very good counsel. You know, Paul Allen Levy from Public Citizen, among others, was representing Yelp in this, and he knows a lot, probably more than anybody on the face of the planet, about these legal issues, and can certainly advocate them as well as anybody on the face, better than anybody on the face of the planet. Yet the court, what made this case a little bit different than Cahill and Dendright and See's Candy and the Mobilisa case in Arizona and, you know, and a few others here, is that Virginia actually has a statute that talks about this as to what standard a court should apply. So the court declined the Yelp's invitation to apply the Cahill standard, which says that you have to come to court with enough facts to support a summary judgment motion in order for the defendants to be anonymous defendants to be unmasked. And that's a huge standard, or that's a huge barrier to overcome at the beginning of the case. So the Virginia statute sets out the standard, and among the factors that a court is to look at is whether or not the defamation plaintiff has a legitimate good faith basis to contend that such a party, that the that it is the victim of actionable conduct, and applying that standard. And there are a few other, you know, points in that test. You know, you have to try to serve, try to find out through other means, give notice, and some other things here. So in this case, the court indeed found that the evidence that the plaintiff had presented was enough to show that the reviews were defamatory, and it had a good faith belief that these weren't customers, but that there truly was a tortious, there was tortious conduct going on here. So, you know, that's the standard that the Virginia court applied. It's right there in the statute. So any critique we could make of this is what I think would be in evaluating whether or not the facts truly do match up with the legal holding here. You know, were those postings, did they really point to defamation having occurred? And that's where the subjective decision of the court has to come in play. But we do see that there, you know, the protection is built into the statute right there, and the statute's been around for a while.
Yeah, the odd thing though is that the court wrote, if the Doe defendants were not customers of Hadid, then their Yelp reviews are defamatory. But the whole question is, were these actual real customers who had written the reviews? So this seems a little bit circular to me.
Yeah, it does. It does present a problem there, because if if indeed it turns out that they, I guess the implication of that is, if they were written by actual customers, they wouldn't be defamatory, right? Is that
right? I think so.
I don't know that I said that correctly, but that's where the circularity of the problem comes in. Well, like, right. If they are identified and it turns out it is different than what the court thought, well, then the First Amendment interest has been violated there. I guess that at that point we say, well, you know, that risk of circularity may be the best that we can do. Because again, there is this interest on the part of the plaintiff in finding that out. And as long as we do this analysis, you know, it may not be perfect, but at least it's something. What we don't want is are the various trial courts to become like the FISA court, to just come in and rubber stamp a bunch of stuff. Right. You know, at some point we got to throw up our hands and say, well, this is the best we can do.
The linchpin seemed to be that the carpet company just needed to have a legitimate good faith basis. And I think that threshold differs in other states, and in this particular state, the threshold seems fairly low. It's just, do they have a legitimate good faith basis?
I think that's about as low of a standard as you could get. You know, the highest standard being the Cahill standard. You know, a summary. You have to come up with enough facts to show that there's no genuine issue of material fact that should be saved trial. You essentially have to prove your case before the other side even has to show up. And then, you know, in between that is, you know, like a prima facie case or enough to survive a motion to dismiss. So yeah, it's definitely a continuum. And I can't think of a lighter burden that a plaintiff would have to carry in a situation than what's articulated in this statute.
Well, it doesn't sound like this would meet the Cahill, you know, you could demonstrate success likely on summary judgment standard. But if you did have It seems to me that the plaintiffs in these cases are sort of cases are hamstrung in a number of ways because they have no access to the identities of the speakers to do discovery. And what they're left with is, you know, their own personal knowledge of what did and did not happen, what is and is not true. So it seems like if they're able to go in and, you know, swear out a statement that absolutely this is, you know, not the way of things, and we're talking about facts and not opinion here, that should at least get them over the threshold. Evan, do you get the feeling from the case law that that's the case?
Well, I mean, I think I imagine if I meditated on that a little bit longer, that's the sentiment I would get, because, mm-hmm. you know, I acknowledge that many times I come into this, these types of scenarios, both, you know, reading cases and talking about them, and also in my legal practice, I have more often than otherwise represented the anonymous John Does in these types of situations. So I come at mm-hmm. it from a very defense-oriented perspective, the First Amendment perspective, saying, you know, where are the weaknesses in the plaintiff's assertions here? So I think perhaps, you know, I need to answer your question fully, Denise, I would need to sit and put myself in the shoes of aggrieved plaintiffs, thinking, oh, well, you know, this is a tough hurdle to get over, mm-hmm. you know, notwithstanding the fact that you know, judges make bad decisions that I think are way too pro-plaintiff in the situations. But I'm just a little bit bitter from some decisions and cases that I've been involved with. That's all that's talking right there.
Right. I think it's really interesting something Cole said a minute ago about 4chan being very proactive in enforcing its community guidelines and terms and kicking people off as soon as they run afoul of them and turning over information as soon as it looks as though, you know, they may have engaged in something unlawful. Because that sort of flies in the face, I think, of the common perception of things like 4chan and Reddit as these kind of wild wests of the internet. And so, Cole, I'm wondering if maybe the common perception is just wrong. I mean, you've certainly looked into this in detail.
Well, I think that they're proactive about the bare minimum that they need to be proactive about. So. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody's trying to post child pornography on Yelp. Mm-hmm. It may look like other platforms are perhaps more lax, but I think that communities like 4chan and to a lesser extent Reddit have to be more vigilant. I mean, even YouTube. I knew a guy who sorted through YouTube videos to make sure no pornography was posted. I mean, there are serious legal repercussions for these platforms when they run afoul of the law. So they have to do their best to moderate. And, you know, when it comes to illegal content, there's no messing around. So, I mean, it isn't complete anarchy on 4chan. It's about as close as you can get to for a site that's hosted in the US. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there are obviously deep web sites that are more along the lines of the Wild West that people talk about.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because you're working on your book on that topic. And for a lot of people, maybe 4chan and Reddit are as deep web as they get, but it gets a lot deeper than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that when I started thinking about it, I actually had a chapter about the deep web in my previous book. And, you know, little did I know that Silk Road and some of these other stories were going to become some of the biggest tech stories of the year. Mm-hmm. So I think that, it's really hard stuff to write about because it's all anonymous sources and you never know if you're being lied to. But it's interesting stuff. I mean, I think it remains to be seen whether this is the direction that the internet is going to go. You know, things like Bitcoin behave as a lubricant for commerce that can't be taxed or monitored, whether or not people are selling, you know, pounds of cocaine or you know, programming services. there's increasing incentive to operate on these black markets, especially around the world where you have even more oppressive governments than we have here in the U.S. So I think that the deep web is going to be an increasingly expanding thing, although with the recent revelations about the demise of Silk Road, I myself have been a little bit nervous to even hang out on some of these websites that are hosted through Tor and other platforms.
Yeah, why is that
from the government?
Yeah, the fact that the I had this plan where I was going to buy an illegal gun through the deep web and assemble it myself and film the whole process, and basically to make the argument that the presence of online weapon sales, while being much more annoying than just going to Walmart and buying a gun, effectively makes forms of gun control potentially meaningless. And I was all set. Sorry?
There was another journalist who was researching Silk Road, and some people there didn't like his presence and actually arranged to send drugs to his house and tell the postmaster so that he would get arrested and go away. So I think you'd have to be concerned both by getting caught up in a dragnet from the government and from the people that you're speaking with.
Well, right. I mean, it's, I'm not a crime journalist, but I think people who study criminal organizations have to worry about this kind of stuff all the time. And anyway, the point of relaying that story is that I'm a lot less prone to behave illegally in order to make a point than I was a year ago or even 6 months ago. There are serious consequences, and there are no legal protections for journalists who are engaging in illegal behavior, as some people have found out in the past and are currently rotting in jail as a result.
I've heard the factoid that the U.S. government, the FBI, is actually one of the biggest holders of Bitcoins now because of all the seizures.
I wouldn't be surprised. I just read that Dread Pirate Roberts, I forget his actual name, but the guy who was running the Silk Road in late December basically petitioned that the government should release his Bitcoins and return them to him. And this while simultaneously his lawyer is making the argument that they've got the wrong guy. So how did you get all those Bitcoins? I have no idea what his strategy is.
So Cole, for those who may not have, read J.D. Lasica's book, The Dark Net, or your earlier book on hacking the future, can you explain how it is? I mean, are sites like the Silk Road just constantly under fire? It seems like they have some stability and the people know about them. So, when we're talking about the deep web, I tend to think of things that I've, that are just completely beyond my ken.
Well, it's touch and go on these sites, and it requires a certain amount of trust in order to fork over cold hard cash. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have found out the hard way that, you throw your Bitcoins into the eBay of online drug sales, and then suddenly the guy who runs the site disappears and runs away with millions of dollars of everyone's Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just like organized crime in the, traditional organized crime that we've had for centuries, where you choose to do business with people who operate outside the law, and you're dealing with people who you may not necessarily be able to trust. So there's tons of money to be made, but it's so risky. This guy, the Silk Road founder, was, I think he had $28 million worth, or $31 million or something like that, dollars worth of Bitcoin seized. And this guy's a 29-year-old dude living in San Francisco, made tens of millions of dollars in a couple of years. Obviously, the rewards are very high, but the risks are very high. And even just as a small user, if I wanted to buy some weed, you're taking on some serious risk. But I think that hackers and criminals are always going to be moving a little bit faster than the feds. So as these things get taken down, we're going to see more sophisticated and entrenched forms of online black market commerce. popping up in the coming years.
So you're not assembling illegal guns to research your book. Can we ask what you are doing?
Well, I have to admit that blurb that you read is a little out of date. The book that I'm writing is not called Deep Web. There's a section about the Deep Web, but it's a broader study of basically technologies that facilitate what I call anarcho-capitalism, or this broad term that defines any kind of society that exists outside the purview of any sovereign nation. So this manifests itself in different ways, both online and off. The Bitcoin community is obviously a big part of this. And then you also have the seasteading community building floating platforms out in the ocean, or at least attempting to. Then you have the Free State Project in New Hampshire that's trying to get enough people to move to the state so that they can slowly dismantle the government and secede from the union. So obviously technology is a huge part of this whole movement of pro-anarchy, and criminals have a lot to gain from it, but I think freedom-loving people might also as well. So I'm just kind of exploring these different small communities that are loosely related under the banner of getting out from under what they consider to be an oppressive federal presence.
All right. Well, as long as we're on the topic of cryptocurrencies in general, Bitcoins in specific, Evan, one of your holiday gifts did not arrive at my house in time for me to ship it to you, so I'm going to give it to you virtually here on the show. And it is a tangible physical Bitcoin. It's not worth anything. It's not an actual Bitcoin, but somebody decided that this virtual currency needed some sort of real world equivalent. And I bought this off of Amazon, and I'm going to send it to you. It's a little copper coin, and it's got the Bitcoin symbol on it. And it came from China. It has Hong Kong postmarks and stamps. So I'll send that along to you too. Your children might enjoy the Chinese stamps.
So, for sure. Well, thank you very much. I feel
welcome.
So enriched. I'm enriched. Yes.
Yes. And I have, you know, hopefully it will track right along with the cryptocurrency and maintain some of its value. Who knows? But along those lines, The Kanye West lawyers are not real wild about cryptocurrency these days, and certainly have some things to say about Kanye West. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Well, sure. And fortunately, this can be a little lighter spirited than the dismantling of the government of Vermont. Did I hear you right?
Say New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. They're just
live free or die.
They're just mirror images of one another, right? So, Kanye West is this, new startup cryptocurrency. I don't know if it's actually launched yet because it was supposed to launch tomorrow, but they had talked about launching earlier. I haven't checked to see if they actually have. But you know, you can see why Kanye West would think there's a problem of somebody using the term Kanye West for anything whatsoever, even if it's unrelated to being a musical performing artist. So Kanye's lawyers sent a cease and desist letter to the developers of Kanye West, which I'm not sure exactly how it happened because they're anonymous developers, but you know, somehow they were put on, delivered this letter. And the Kanye's lawyers are asserting that this is a trademark infringement and a misappropriation of Kanye's rights of publicity. And I think there was also an assertion of copyright infringement for some use of a video or something like that in connection with the promotion. So this presents some really interesting issues because, you know, if you think about what trademark infringement is and what the misappropriation of the right of publicity is, you know, for somebody to be violating one of those rights, they've got to be, and I'm going way out here at a general level to kind of bring in trademarks and right of publicity into the same sphere of or circle of discussion here. You got to be using that term or that name or image, persona, whatever, in commerce in connection with some form of goods or services. So is cryptocurrency really something, the distribution of that an activity which would have those rights attached to it. The real interesting point to discuss on this is there's an assertion in the cease and desist letter. Again, this is not a lawsuit, at least as of the time before the show started today. I wasn't aware of Kanye West's lawyers filing a lawsuit. This is just a cease and desist letter, so they can say pretty much anything they want to, just only at risk of triggering a declaratory judgment action. But one of the things that the lawyers say is that we will, if you don't change the name before launching, we're going to go after all the users of this cryptocurrency for contributory infringement of trademark and, only heaven knows whatever else they would assert against the users of the cryptocurrency, the cryptocurrency community at large. You know, the threat was, if you don't stop, we're going to notify the community at large, however you would do that. I guess you go to a subreddit or something like that. So I just think this is really an interesting legal issue because, would the claims of trademark infringement or misappropriation of the right of publicity for using the Coinye, it's just been shortened to that since now they've dropped the West, the Coinye cryptocurrency, would that really give rise on the part of the users of trademark infringement or misappropriation? Because going back to what I was talking about before, you've got to use it in connection with something, in commerce with something. If you're just using currency to have a monetary exchange, you're not providing the goods and services. That, I mean, at least those are not the goods and services you're providing in that exchange. It's the thing for which you are asking consideration. So I think that's kind of it's an interesting assertion to make. And I would think that lawyers as smart as the ones that Kanye has hired would have thought that through. But I don't think it's an easy, clear path right away to say that mere users of a cryptocurrency are using that name in commerce in the trademark sense or somehow appropriating the right of publicity embodied in the name of that cryptocurrency merely by using it. It's just the nature of the decentralized nature of the system. So it's an interesting, the assertions raise some interesting questions about trademarks and right of publicity.
Right. It's as though you're asserting, if we go back to your real world Bitcoin that I'm going to send you here, it's as though you're asserting that the mere possessor of a piece of property that might be infringing is somehow liable just because of the possession. And that doesn't fly under the law.
Yeah, right, certainly not trademarks.
There was a case between Apple, the producers of Beetle, and Apple Software, right? And depending on how that went, if you were an Apple computer user, could you be, told to give up your computer because the Beatles won, or if you owned an Apple record from the Beatles and the Apple computer company won, would you say, oh, I have to get rid of all my records now?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think there's a couple of, that's a good analogy to talk about things. And, analogies always get interesting where you can see where they don't map up, where they depart and break down. I mean, with the physical object, you've got notions under the first sale doctrine, the exhaustion doctrine, where, you can't, a trademark holder can't stop somebody from selling something lawfully acquired to a subsequent purchaser. The doctrine kind of plays in both copyright and trademark law. There's that. And then there was something else, but I forgot because I was just thinking of George Harrison all of a sudden or something.
Well, it seems like both the lawyers for Kanye West and any judge that might get their hands on this case would benefit. There was this great post on Medium called "Explain Bitcoin Like I'm Five." Have you guys seen this?
It's not possible.
It's a really nice, concise explanation. It was posted by, let's see, who's the Medium user there? Thanks. It's all the way at the bottom, perhaps. I'm missing it. Nixter with a five for the S, posting in the future of currency topic on Medium, has a really nice explanation of, comparing Bitcoins to apples and then digital apples and how you it explains the whole ledger process and the public ledger, et cetera. So for anyone that needs to be able to wrap their head around how this all works. It's a nice introduction. And I think, you know, it comes into play when we're talking about, well, how are you going to impose liability to the users of this kind of a cryptocurrency if the actual provider of the currency is who allegedly violated trademark or right of publicity considerations. All right, let's go ahead and make Coinye our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. I promised Joseph that we would talk about shared endorsements as well, since that's kind of a big thing coming into play as we start the new year here. Google's terms of service changed, and we have shared endorsements now coming into play. First of all, can you explain for anyone who hasn't been following exactly what that is and what it means, what the change is and what a shared endorsement is, Joseph?
Sure. And I can even frame it a little bit in terms of what we spoke of before of scammers right. and reputation sites and things like that. And mm-hmm. so basically, if we were to be a little bit suspicious, we might say sites like Yelp and Google Plus and Facebook, you know, they want to get rid of the scammers and the polluters because they want to manipulate things for their own interests in a way. And since we can no longer trust the web as a network of links because people are always prone to manipulating and spamming it, people are moving towards, well, what happens if we could make recommendations to you based on what your friends suggest, right? And so that's the social graph. That's the power of the social graph. And both Facebook and Google are moving towards being able to send you advertisements, not based on the fact that it comes at the top of the Google page, but that your friends recommended it to you. And there was actually a pretty funny case of this to illustrate it, whereby at some point, there's a lot of funny reviews of Amazon products, just ridiculous products. And like there's a 50-gallon drum of lubricant that you can purchase. And someone joining in the fun on Facebook had said something like, yeah, you know, it's good all year round, not just for Valentine's Day. And this person's photo ended up appearing in advertisements for this product. And they were like, whoa, 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 I was just kind of joking around and sending messages, and now my face is appearing in endorsements. So these endorsements are basically, if you like a product, you are liable to be then shown endorsing that product to the people who Google or Facebook think you would influence, like your friends and mother and brothers or whomever it might be. And there's a real question like, have I agreed to appear in commercial endorsements just because I liked something?
Well, that seems like something that, you know, obviously Google's lawyers are very smart about these things and will make sure that their terms of service have covered whatever particular use that you want to make of the endorsement. But that gets us into the question of whether people really understand those terms and have, you know, given meaningful consent to their endorsements being used in this way. Evan, do you see trouble on the horizon for Google over this?
Well, I mean, I come at it as just from a personal privacy perspective, and you know, for what actions like this do for me is just to drive me away. Where if I were, you know, to disclose a bunch of information, it would just be in ways that it's not searchable, not indexable. I guess on the
right,
the dark web.
They make you into a man on strike.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I'm just going to opt out and, you know, more. I guess if I was going to do that, I would do it more in a Timothy Leary way, or I don't know, maybe become Amish. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
When Facebook first launched this sort of thing, people did push back and Facebook eased off. But interestingly, one of the Facebook product managers said something like, this product is going away in name, but not in principle. We just have to figure out a different way to do this so our users are more comfortable with it. So their belief might be if they can educate people and tell them nothing horrible is going to happen, then maybe we'll accept it, because it's definitely where they're driving towards.
Right. Stephen Levy has a really nice bit of reporting over at Wired.
Everybody kind of laughed when...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say everybody kind of laughed when Snapchat announced their multi-billion-dollar potential offer. And, you know, I laugh too, but the more I think about it, the more I see people reacting against this kind of behavior that's mm-hmm. just completely tone deaf and assuming that people want to engage with brands when they just want to experience behavior in a pretty solid argument for the free market solution to some of these problems.
Right. And that puts us into the boat of having to look at it as, you know, obviously these companies have, on the one hand, the PR issue of trying to keep your information secure and from the government in the wake of the revelations that we've had this last year from Edward Snowden and the various analyses and speculations that ensued in tornado fashion thereafter. And the fact that they are all, you know, using our information for their own benefit, and the hypocrisy of that is pointed out in a really nice bit of reporting from Stephen Levy over at Wired, sort of a retrospective on PRISM called How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet, that I encourage folks to check out. So, Evan, you've been pondering this and writing a bit about it on your blog, the whole trade-off between convenience and privacy. And I'm wondering, you know, in the context of shared endorsements here, obviously you've taken a personal stand on that, but how do you think culturally things will shake out?
Well, I think that just our ideas and our sensibilities collectively as a culture will probably view privacy as less important. I mean, we have people squawking about privacy. We've got organizations like Epic, and we've got privacy pragmatists like Cash Hill informing us of all the things, you know, showing us the, you know, shining a spotlight on all the ways that we can suffer from the self-inflicted harms of disclosing too much information, whether to others or to a single entity. And despite all of that, all of those warnings and those notions that we should be more aware of, people tend to adopt social media, or people are adopting social media at ever-increasing rates. You know, mobile technology, which is inextricably tied with transmitting more information about oneself, that's becoming more prevalent. You know, the quantified self, uploading physiological information to the cloud. I mean, we could sit here all day and come up with examples of just how we are collecting more information about ourselves, and we're not just keeping it, you know, copied on a local hard drive. We're putting it in the cloud and making it accessible being able to allow algorithms that are outside of the four walls of our enterprise to be run against that information. So I see a kind of an unstoppable momentum toward that, but it doesn't stop or it doesn't do anything to obscure or diminish the importance of that trade-off between, it's really a personal liberty trade-off. You know, there are these wonderful conveniences that can be have. And what stirred me to write, you know, just a real short blog post at the end of the year was this idea of Google talking about how it wants to become the perfect personal assistant. And it got me thinking of larger issues of actually social justice. I wouldn't call myself an SJW by any means. That was something that we were talking about earlier, social justice warrior. But I was thinking about these things in terms of social justice and larger questions of augmented reality. Because something like having a personal assistant that relies on troves of information about you being stored in the cloud, and, you know, having algorithms coming in various angles and different, you know, processing and computation done on that data, you know, that is just by its very nature indisputably privacy destroying. But if those technologies are widely adopted and 98-99% of people are using them so that it becomes something that is normal, to where everybody walks around and you're just like, I imagine an idea of someday where, you know, Google Glass would be viewed as way too ostentatious, where everything is either implanted in your brain or you're wearing some kind of contact lens that allows you to transmit and receive information from the World Wide Web, the internet, the cloud, what have you. You know, if everybody's doing that, then, you know, those people who are not doing that will be put at a real disadvantage in many different situations, informationally, even physically, with, you know, other forms of augmented reality. If you're, if everybody goes around and their bodies are stronger and more resilient because of artificial intelligence and augmenting technologies, then what about those people who choose to not do that? You know, what are their rights, you know, to not be discriminated against because they've chosen to not self-inflict, or at least try to mitigate the privacy harms that they are inflicting on themselves.
The augmented folks get hacked. I mean, one of the interesting things to me about, I think we're one of the first places we're likely to see augmentation and automation is with driving. But one of the questions I've had, and I'd be curious for your perspective as a lawyer, is imagine that Google succeeds and we have automated highways, and it cuts down on the amount of traffic accidents and deaths by a significant amount. We now have a tenth of the traffic accidents we used to have. But still, for those people who are killed in the few traffic accidents that do have, I imagine they're going to be very, very upset, and they're going to sue Google and other sort of robotic, augmented makers of products for a significant amount of money. So I'm wondering about the liability issues associated with these technologies.
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of a perennial overarching question. Scholars like Ryan Kahlo are, you know, spending a lot of time thinking about that and trying best to draw analogies from the law that we have. Section 230 comes into play there. You know, this idea of immunity for the provider of a technology, you know, and gun you know, immunities that have been extended to gun makers plays into this as well. So there's the question of the liability for the provider of the system. And then there's the question of liability for those who choose not to buy into the system and drive the car on their own, you know, based on their own vigilance and perception, you know, driving their own darn car without, you know, getting into the system, not doing a self-driving car. You know, they have an accident that could have been prevented had they not been engaged in automated driving.
So that'll be
driving.
What's the equivalent of drunk driving in the future.
Right, right.
You had the nerve, the temerity to drive your own car.
Yeah, right, yeah.
The shifting of the standard of reasonable care in tort law also probably of insurance rates. You know, Evan, you're talking about how are the people who opt out going to be impacted or discriminated against? That would certainly be one way.
Right. And, you know, it's just different now than what it has been in the past, because we could a way that somebody could argue against me is to say that, well, look, you know, we didn't enact laws to protect people who chose not to name your revolutionary technology, use the printed word, or that chose not to use gunpowder or not to drive an automobile. You know, we think of some paradigm shifting technology. We've never looked at it and think, oh, well, if you choose not to use it, you deserve some kind of special protection.
The only case I can think of is people who abstain from medical technology for their children because of religious.
That's an excellent example. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's an excellent example. So, I mean, but with there, maybe that ties into what I'm thinking of here. My starting point is, you know, I don't want the government stepping in and protecting people for the decisions that they make. If they make the decision, well, then they ought to pay the consequences for it. But I'm just, you know, thinking about this broadly and thinking of the implications about it. Never before would the individual run the risk of the same kind of risk of not taking these technologies because of what's at stake here. I could have, like, this is great. I can have the second opportunity to bring up the Amish. You know, the Amish have chosen not to use many, this time in a more serious context, the Amish have chosen to not use many modern technologies because of their, you know, their fundamental view of the world and the cosmos and their place in it. Well, that's fine. They don't necessarily suffer. You know, they would suffer only in as much as, you know, if they did use those technologies, only in as much as, well, now they're more likely to die in a car accident. This is an erudite point, so I don't know if it's erudite or not. Maybe it's stupid, but it's unclear in my mind right now. But if you choose not to opt into privacy destroying technologies, you're preserving the sanctity of your own personal privacy and dignity and not having people know about you. And then the downside of that would, if you did opt into it, would be, well, your privacy is destroyed. That's a different harm to you than if you choose to you know, purchase or buy into the idea of other modern technologies that we've seen heretofore. And that's what makes me think that, well, maybe from a regulatory and policy standpoint, maybe we would need to step in and protect those people who choose not to engage in augmenting technologies that really destroy some other aspect of personal dignity, e.g. privacy.
Cole, as someone who's thought a lot about privacy and anonymity and not opting into technologies that are easily trackable, do you see a qualitative difference between eschewing those kinds of technologies and eschewing other sort of paradigm shifting technologies that Evan was referring to, you know, the printed word, et cetera?
Well, I mean, I think you could take it a step further even and say that people who decide to opt out, it might be impossible for them to opt out. If everyone's mm-hmm. walking around wearing Google Glass, even if I'm not wearing Google Glass, I'm still being recorded. So, I mean, there are tons of thorny issues you can extrapolate out. I will say that it concerns me less to have corporate surveillance than government surveillance, mainly because there seems to be an ability to opt out of corporate surveillance much more so than government surveillance. And I think that it's become clear to many over the last year that there's a lot that can go on within the government that's supposed to be this thing that we can affect with voting and activism that none of us even knew about. That's stuff that's not good and that we don't want. So I like Bruce Schneier's, who's a technologist and a security expert and a privacy activist. He makes the argument that we now have security fiefdoms that are ruled by companies like Google and Facebook. And we basically put trust in these companies. And we say, I'm going to give you my information. I trust you to not abuse that. You can, you know, sell me ads against that information. That's like the exchange. But at least everything is basically out in the open, which is something that I don't think you necessarily have with government surveillance. So I like the idea of security fiefdoms. I like the idea of there being pressures put on companies to offer better security and privacy platforms than other companies. So, you know, I'm not saying that we have a perfectly free market and that it always works out that the best company wins with the best privacy platform, but I think we have something approximating that. And, you know, I have no problem putting faith in certain companies for the convenience benefits that it grants me. But I also love the fact that we have things like Tor and Bitcoin, which provide some kind of last resort option for privacy for people who live in oppressive places, who might not have a security fiefdom that they want to apply their loyalty to. I like that we have cryptographers trying to figure out unbreakable codes so that there is a sort of last resort security option.
I think that's a really nice note to end this discussion on and move on to our resources and tips of the week. A couple of tips for you this week. A big sigh of relief, I think, coming from those entering the workplace who have for the last several years been in college or otherwise messing around and posting their lives on Facebook. Not that everyone in college messes around, but there was a study done, just recently released by researchers at several universities and also Accenture, that privacy pragmatist Cash Hill highlighted on her site recently. And what the crux of it is, and she's got a whole bunch of information on how the data was gathered and you know, who responded and what's included in the analysis here. But the underlying point is they asked a whole bunch of recruiters to judge job applicants' future performance based on their ratings of the applicants' Facebook profiles. They wanted to see how accurate those ratings and judgments were. You know, could you really judge those books by their Facebook cover? And according to the study, there was approximately zero correlation between the conclusions of the recruiters and the actual job performance these people had down the road. So the tip there is, you know, definitely be cognizant of the other traditional means of analyzing and assessing potential employees. You know, obviously you don't want someone who looks like they've completely given leave of judgment, but a couple of lapses of judgment on Facebook aren't going to leave you with a bad employee, according to this study. So go check that out on Cash's site. My other tip for you, and you know, I hate to just put this out there as and squelch the hopes of anybody who really has a passion to go into law and grapple with the law and policy issues that we deal with on the show every week. But really not a good time to be getting out of law school and being one of those applicants that with or without a bad track record on your Facebook page. There's a story over at Business Insider about a woman named Jacqueline Young who graduated with quite a bit, $100,000 in debt from law school, very common story. From the University of Nebraska's law school, which is ranked number 61 in the United States, and was completely unable to get a job. The good news is, because of all of the other opportunities that the internet facilitates, she was actually able to start a business that had nothing to do with being a lawyer. She herself says, I wouldn't go to law school again, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. So just be aware that, you know, your ticket to gainful employment as a lawyer is, you know, as much in jeopardy as it's ever been right now. But Jacqueline didn't let that get her down. She actually started a business where she sells sports-related accessories. She started out at kids' tournaments and has a website as well. And they look like cool things. And, you know, so here she is not being a lawyer at all, but she's paid off $40,000 worth of her law school debt. I'm going to definitely pick up one of her headbands, which look really cool and look like they'd actually stay on. With this hair, you need a headband that's going to stay on. So good for you, Jacqueline. And just a cautionary tale to those who are thinking about going to law school. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there right now. Our resources of the week, really good one along the lines of our discussion on reviews and how to deal with negative reviews. If you're going to go try and concoct that conspiracy theory and go after the people who are posting negative reviews of you online, this is also from Professor Goldman. He's discussing how doctors should respond to negative online reviews. But his advice here is really applicable to any business person who's grappling with, okay, so there are negative reviews on me. What do I do about it? They're, you know, not true, or they're not fair, or what have you. And he urges caution and reason, and gives, you know, statistics and analysis about the fact that most of the lawsuits about these reviews don't go anywhere. So, you know, he very much is in the camp of, you know, you've got to let the wisdom of the crowds have its way with the online reviews. And if, you know, you're a good business person, then that's going to come through. So check that out if that's an issue that you've been grappling with. And also, I think this is wonderful fun for anyone who listens to the show. This isn't the first time that Professor Goldman has posted one of his internet law exams. He posted the exam he gave in December over at his site, and we have the link in our discussion points for you. And it's just a hysteria. You know, he prides himself on coming up with really funny and convoluted and very, very realistic and sort of torn from today's headlines fact patterns for his internet law exams. So go test yourself. See how well you've been listening to the show and how you would analyze this fact pattern that he puts out there that includes smearing a celebrity on an online dating site. There's some sexually transmitted disease that comes up, and also a little bit of parody and perhaps misuse of somebody's certainly not misuse by Professor Goldman, but misuse of somebody's well-known celebrity name. Smiley Papyrus is one of the protagonists in his fact pattern here. So it's really good fun. You should go check that out. So Evan, great to be back at it. I've really enjoyed our discussion today. Thanks so much for joining us as always.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, great to be here. Glad to, glad the new year's underway and, good to get the wheels turning again. It's been a very provocative and informative and, indeed enlightening discussion. So really have enjoyed it. Great time.
Yeah, me too. Joseph, really wonderful that you could take the time and join us today. Is there anything else that you want to mention to our viewers and listeners, anything you're working on or that they should be paying attention to before we sign off?
You can always check me out at regal.org/Joseph. Follow my research blog if you'd like. The book comment is probably going to be out next year, actually, so it'll be a little bit of time.
All right. Well, we do look forward to that, and we really, really appreciate the time and cogent comments and incisive analyses you've given us here today. And the same goes for you, Cole. We look forward to your forthcoming book, and we wish you good luck in finishing it up.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
All right, folks, we're really glad that you could join us today. If you're joining us live, that means that you've been listening at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC at live at twit.tv. And if you can't join us live, that is when we record the show. But if you can't join us live, head on over to twit.tv/twill and you'll find our whole archive of shows. We also have a YouTube channel. If that makes life easier for you, it's at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're on iTunes. We're on Roku. However you like to find this kind of netcast, educational and entertainment, we are going to be there for you. And we're so glad that you're there for us and that you are wonderful helps, not only while we're doing the show in IRC, but while we're prepping the shows, in between the shows, suggesting guests, suggesting topics, etc., you can do that by getting in touch with us by email. Evan is evan@twit.tv. I'm Denise@twit.tv. He's Internet Cases on Twitter. I am D Howell over there. We also have Facebook and Google Plus pages for the show, where if you need to expound in more detail, that's probably the best place to do it. We check those and definitely not only let you know what's going on in our heads, but we love what's going on in yours and hearing about them and issues that may come up for you or flag your attention as interesting. So don't forget to send us a note when something pops up on your radar. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Thanks so much for joining us.